Coming up on Tech Nation, the founding executive editor at Wired Magazine, Kevin Kelly. After decades in the technology trenches and a very interesting life, he gives us excellent advice for living, wisdom I wish I'd known earlier. Then, one out of every four adults has heartburn, or more formally, GERD. From everyday people to smokers to especially firefighters, this can lead to esophageal cancer, a diagnosis which often comes too late. Dr. LaShawn Acklog from Lucid Diagnostics describes their two-minute test, which can detect the precancerous state. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
In 2010, I spoke with Nicholas Carr, the former executive editor of the Harvard Business Review and author of the book The Shallows. He asks a simple question: what is the internet doing to our brains? He writes, "We routinely become dependent on popular, useful technologies." He specifically used the word dependent and not addicted.
I think we talk about too many things in terms of addiction these days. And even though I certainly, from my own experience, I know there's a kind of a compulsive quality sometimes to what you do online, I think the problem with talking about it in terms of addiction is that it makes it seem like it's just purely a personal matter and even a personal choice that we, you know, check our email every 15.
I can stop cocaine and email anytime.
That's right. But what that kind of overlooks is the fact that our business expectations, employment expectations, social expectations, education expectations, they're all kind of pushing us toward feeling we have to be always connected. So the hard thing about, you know, backing away a little bit is that you start to feel socially isolated, or you start to feel like you're endangering your career. So it's not just a matter of, oh, I need to quit. It's how entwined is this technology in my everyday life, and can I even quit?
Yeah, your employer does not expect you to continue your cocaine habit, but he does expect you to be online, maybe even when you're on vacation. In fact, a good friend of mine went to work for a French company and started, unfortunately, like July 28th, and didn't understand anything about August and France. She almost got fired because, boy, she was working up a storm in August. She goes, "These people, they're not here. I can't find them." And it's like, "It's French company. It'll work in August." And then by the time she caught up with it, she was mightily embarrassed. But we're talking about, you know, in the U.S., our culture is you ought to be present. You may have flown around the world to do a deal. Well, we don't care what time it is there. You need to be responsive. And that's certainly a new culture, and it's not helped by all this modern technology.
Right. And it's really crept in just in, you know, when you think about it, in the last 10 years or so, suddenly our kind of workday has expanded to from the moment we wake up, and often the first thing people do these days is check their iPhone or their BlackBerry when they get out of bed.
I sleep with my laptop. You don't think that's wrong?
And it goes until you go to bed. And then, you know, a lot of people wake up at 3 and then do it some more. So it really has. It's unlike other technologies that, you know, we've worried about in the past, things like TV. We spent a lot of time watching TV, but it was actually segregated from a lot of our daily life, whereas being connected with the internet and digital media now is all day long.
And a lot of people watch their TV on their computer.
Right, which is another phenomenon that is really exploding now.
You write that with all the new technology, now when you read, you get fidgety, lose the thread, begin looking for something else to do. I feel like I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle. Is that true, Nick?
That is true. And that was the original inspiration for the book was my own personal experience. And throughout my life, I've been a big reader and found it easy to immerse myself in books. And then, you know, recently in the last few years, I've noticed I'll sit down with a book and I'll, you know, get a page or two in. And in my mind, I can almost feel it wants to behave like it behaves when I'm sitting at a computer. It wants to, you know, enough with this page. Let me jump to another site. Let me do some Googling here. Let me check my email. And I really, not only when I was reading, but I really found it a struggle to kind of tune out distractions and concentrate on one thing.
And you were, well, actually, your master's in English. I don't know if your undergraduate's in English as well, English Lit.
Yes,
so
yeah.
You spent a lot of time just reading.
Yeah.
And that would be hard for you to do today.
It would. And I began to connect that disability, as I saw it, with my use of technology.
I've been speaking with Nicholas Carr about his 2010 book, The Shallows. It ultimately became a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and continues to be a bestseller on Amazon today. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
5 Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Kevin Kelly follows his books, What Technology Wants and The Inevitable. He's here today with excellent advice for living, wisdom I wish I'd known earlier. Then Dr. LaShawn Acklog from Lucid Diagnostics tells us about the path from GERD to, unfortunately, esophageal cancer, and about Lucid's 2-minute diagnostic test, which can detect precancerous cells.
TechNation is underwritten in part by MindK, a global software development force in a world where every business can be global, on the web at mindk.com.
And now, Kevin Kelly. Well, Kevin, welcome back to TechNation.
It's always a delight to join you, Maura, and I've been looking forward to this, catching up, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, so am I. Well, you know, we've known each other for years, and you've certainly lived through the personal technology boom. The founding editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, whose founders, Louis Rossetto and Jane Medcalf, came on 6 weeks into a newborn Tech Nation to tell us about this magazine they were about to launch, Wired Magazine. You were the founding editor-in-chief. I had not yet met you. But through all of that, this experience took you through the dot-com boom and bust, smartphones, the Internet of Things, and even more things, social media, and the list goes on. And now you've written a short book of pithy advice originally intended just for your young children as they became adults. How important, if at all, was living through all of that experience in forming this book?
Yes, that's a great question. So the book is called Excellent Advice for Living, and it's kind of broad, but it has been influenced by my experience in living through several generations of technological change at this point. And I got to see how important it is to define your success, whether it's an individual or even in a company, a corporate way. And I got to, and I learned about careers, having seen my own and people around me, and then also having hired many people for Wired right out of college and seeing what their lives are like with that experience. And then I guess witnessing the generation and the invention of world-changing technology also gave me some ideas and experience and advice about being creative and where that kind of creativity that actually is very potent, where that comes from. So I would say there was a lot of the advice in this book has its genesis in that time period.
And of course, there is some technology influence in that you had a self-imposed rule that each should be short enough to be tweetable.
Right.
So you still have your finger on the pulse, Kevin.
Right.
Your finger is on the pulse.
Yes. that was a secondary effect. I was not starting with thinking that they have to be tweetable, but I realized that they actually traveled very well on the social medias when they worked. So that became a little bit of kind of a test later on, was, will this tweet?
WTT. I can see it now in all the writer's workshops. Writer's workshop.
Right.
Now, in books like these, which I don't often interview people about, but I tend to start with the last piece of advice. And here it is.
Mm.
Advice like these are not laws. They are like hats. If one doesn't fit, try another.
Yes. I'm trying to let you know that this is not the word of God. These are not like 10 commandments. These are closer to suggestions and reminders. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, a lot of the advice, not all of it, but a lot of it is ancient, timeless advice that would have come basically or been said by the Stoics or Confucius in the Bible. One person called, oh, this is the Bible without stories. Yeah, that's about right. There's a bunch of ancient wisdom that hasn't, that's eternal. There's other that's sort of more practical and more current, but there is an aspect that it's, I'm channeling the wisdom of the ages in a vocabulary that might make sense today. And it is something that is out of ordinary for me. But in another way, it's I just love this telegraphic medium of like trying to take a whole book and reduce it down to one sentence. It's like, can I do that? And that was a little kind of intellectual challenge, was can I reduce this really kind of important thing to just 10 words? And if I succeeded, then that delights me.
Well, I actually had a breakthrough. I just didn't go to the last one. I actually went one before the last one.
Right.
And I thought, ooh, this is good. No, I'm not going through the entire book backwards. But promise to you, Kevin, promise to all listeners. But it was good. Your goal is to be able to say on the day before you die that you have fully become yourself.
Yes. Yes. Fully become yourself. This is a high bar, I have to tell you. This is a really high bar, and that's why it's like the day before you die. Because for most of us, including me, it's going to take most of our lives to kind of figure out who we are. You know, I think you've done a better job than most people of kind of like becoming you and the best you. But it's really hard to do. And it takes most of our lives to get there. And so it's not like really a destination so much as it is a direction where we kind of keep moving towards the best of us or the better of us. Or the way I like to put it is, don't aim to be the best, aim to be the only. So we want to be the only us, the only person who can do this. We want to be able to work in something where it's just us. Our occupation is me. That's you. I mean, it's like, who else has this thing that you do? I mean, you have a wonderful onlyness about you. And I think that is part of what we can all be aiming for, even though we don't really ever arrive there.
Thank you so much for saying that. And there are other hints in the book about, you know, it's becomingness. And yes, I've a lot of onlys. That's kind of what interested me. But in truth, when you start out and you're an only,
yeah,
and every time you do something nobody's ever done before, which a habit I definitely got when I was at NASA, because you never did anything that anybody else ever did before.
Right.
But it's like you do bear the criticism of the world.
Exactly.
You're not going to be successful. You're not going to. Nobody wants this, or they would have done it before.
Right.
Where are best practices?
You're not going to be successful according to the old definitions of success. And part of what I think life is about is inventing a new way to succeed. And that's what I would say that you've done. And that's what I'm working on is inventing a new way to succeed. And that is, you know, that's part of what this journey is about. And so you don't succeed by the old definitions of success. And that's, by the way, the reason why you want to have invent your own way to succeed is because, like, if you're trying to be like an NBA, like a basketball star, or you want to be a lawyer, accountant, those are very well occupied places. that have a very, very defined success, and they're limited. You know, how many basketball players can there be? So there's incredible competition. It's incredibly difficult. It's basically someone else's movie that you're trying to succeed in. And so if you go your own way and your own movie, you have a much higher chance of kind of arriving there, because if you're being the only, there's no competition.
This is it. You're defining it.
You're defining it. Right. And so it's one of my pieces of advice in the book is that if at all possible, you want to be working in an area where there's no words or language for what it is that you're doing, where it takes, you know, kind of like a long time to explain to your mother and father what it is you actually do. Right. And so that's a good sign that you're on the right track, because you are more likely to be cultivating something that only you can do, because it's going to be ahead of the language. There's no previous definition of success. And it also means that you don't have a lot of competition. And it also means that you're much more likely to be at the place where there'd be a breakthrough, because that's where the breakthroughs happen. They happen out there where nothing has been before, where we don't have a language to describe it.
And that's where the rewards are.
Absolutely.
Now, they may not be the rewards society is talking about,
right?
But they feed into you. You became your best you.
Exactly.
And who you are.
Yeah. And by the way, the one thing I want to say about it, this also applies to a business, to a startup, as it implies to an individual. It's the same kind of a thing. Whatever the business you want to be doing, you also want to be doing that. And it's tough. It's difficult because, as we said, you're uncategorizable. No one knows where to put you. There's no other comparables. It's the market is small. The failure rate's high. You know, there's all these things against you. So it's not easy, and there's no guarantee of success. But the upside is so large that that's generally where you should try to aim, if at all possible.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Kevin Kelly, the founding executive editor at Wired Magazine. His journalism credentials are long, having written for The New York Times, The Economist, and Science. And his insights are always interesting, as are his books, including What Technology Wants and The Inevitable. He's here today with excellent advice for living, wisdom I wish I'd known earlier. Now, I'm assuming that all your advice is not limited to this book, and now you are currently a senior maverick at Wired. So my question is simple. How did you work your way up from being just a maverick to being a senior maverick? And what is that anyway?
Right. Who are the junior mavericks?
Yeah.
Yes, that's obviously, it's a made-up, self-assigned honorific title at Wired. I have no responsibilities. I get no pay. It's equivalent of an editor at large. But what it does suggest is, it's actually reflective of my role while I was at Wired, where I also didn't really have any reporting responsibilities, where my job was to try and keep us at Wired from doing the ordinary and expected. That was the maverick part. And I was the oldest person. And I think we had almost 100 employees or more. And I was still the only person that had kids. Right?
That's right.
That just shows you. Like, I was the elder guy, even though I wasn't the oldest person. It's really, really hard. I mean, I talk about imagination a lot and the role and the value of imagination in overcoming fear and becoming optimistic. But it's the most difficult thing about becoming more imaginative is forgetting what we know, forgetting what everybody knows, forgetting what we ourselves expect the future to be, because the future is very likely to be unreasonable. Look where we are today. Right. I mean, look at the world today. You could not. If we described this to 20 years ago, you would say, nah, No, that's
we're not even going to publish this in Wired magazine. No,
right, exactly. This is too outrageous.
That's for sure. And you know, it's not all serious. I mean, I love the be nice to your children because they're going to choose your nursing home. Directly to your kids. But still, a lesson for us all. Unhappiness comes from wanting what others have. Happiness comes from wanting what you already have.
Right. Yes. That's I'm sure it's a Stoic or a biblical principle as well. There is this idea of being content with what you have already earned, going back to, you know, because the story is about people who have achieved a lot and still want more. A bunch of billionaires kind of together, and somebody who was not a billionaire, and he was saying basically, you know, I have the one thing that none of you have, and that's enough.
Yeah. This is true. Don't live in the Silicon Valley greater area don't see. I mean, I was talking to someone and he said to me, you know, but I don't have $1 billion. I'm not worth $1 billion. It's like, well, yeah. I don't have your problem, I don't have that problem.
Yeah. Well, it's actually a problem. Here's my advice to all your listeners. If at all possible, do whatever you can to never be a billionaire. You do not want to be a billionaire.
I'm in luck.
I'm serious. You do not want $1 billion. It becomes an incredible burden. It becomes an incredible burden for you. It becomes something that you always have to deal with. It becomes something of a real problem for your kids in terms of being able to, like, how do you decide what the limits are? What are their expectations? I mean, it's really warps, incredibly difficult for child rearing. So you do not want to have what you think, because here's the other thing. Almost anything you think you want to do with $1 billion, you don't need $1 billion for, is way too much. It just becomes an incredible burden for every single person that I met with that. Okay, $100 million, fine. All right. You don't want $1 billion. Don't get $1 billion.
And if you make more and give it away, don't tell anybody you gave it away. Anonymous, anonymous, anonymous.
That's right.
Never. I don't know why. Never go to over 100 million. I don't know why.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Now, something that I think is not just good for a person, but good for society, for communities, families, relationships, is here's one. The most effective remedy for anger is delay.
Yeah. That, I'm sure, is the Stoics. Channeling the Stoics. But yes, make a decision to now not be outraged today, right? Just choose, I'm not going to be outraged today. And you can be on Twitter and not be outraged. I know, because I do. And I just decided that I'm not going to be outraged. And that is a deliberate choice. And you can do that. And if you do, man, your day would be so much better. So much better.
And by tomorrow, things will look differently.
Right, right. Yeah. You can say, well, I'll yell at that person tomorrow. Okay? That's all you have to say. And then tomorrow, you'll just forget about it. So not today. Today, I will not be outraged.
And yet, you write, you are as big as the things that make you angry.
That's right. So if you get angry over little things, you're a little person. You want to be a big person. Reserve your anger for things that are going to be worthy of the kind of penalty that they impose even on yourself, right? Because when you get angry, it's eroding you. It's like if you project hate or something, hate doesn't really affect the other person. They're not even aware of it. It's going to just corrode you. So you want to have a grudge. You want to release them as if they were toxin on you. So if you get angry, that costs you. And so if you're going to pay that price, it really ought to be worth it.
Now, here's one that requires a little science or engineering or math, however you want to look at it. But we'll try it anyway. When working with electricity, volts hurt, but amps kill.
Yeah.
Now, I think you have a non-technical reason for saying this.
Well, no, it's not. It's just sort of more practical. It's the, you know, like when you walk across the carpet and you get a little shock from the static electricity, that's a very, very high voltage. But there's almost no amps, so it doesn't really hurt. But it doesn't take, you know, if you have a lot of amps, it doesn't take much voltage for those amps to really kill you. I mean, so if you get, you know, 30, 40, you can get up to 100 amps, that, you know, almost at any voltage, that's really, really going to hurt. So the number to pay attention to is not the volts. We think high voltage. But high voltages and low amps is really not so harmful. But amps, even at low voltages or fairly low voltages, can really kill you.
So how do you translate that to human activity, human emotion, human relationships?
Oh, and yeah. So I was using it in a literal sense. So like if you're working with electricity, it was not a metaphor for anything.
Really? I'm like, you had me, Kevin. I was like, okay. So when you take the hammer, you know, like be careful how you hold the nail, like in that.
Yeah. No, I'm just literally saying if you're messing around with electricity, be careful of the amps.
Well, that's a good one. That's a good one. Well, but of course, there's some other practical ones in here that are not quite so obtuse. For me, not for you or the general reader. To get your message across, follow this formula used by ad writers everywhere. Simplify, 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 then exaggerate.
Right. So this came from Wired. Like you had to tell people what you were doing. So we were doing things at Wired and we thought it was kind of obvious to people what it was that we're doing. But you actually have to tell them what it is that you're doing. It's kind of like crazy. That's why we kind of did these taglines on the front. It was like, yeah. I mean, it's like you can't be subtle about it. You actually have to be very, very explicit. And that's true, I found, even for individuals, is that you kind of have to tell people, this is what I am about.
And you have to, if you followed your advice, to be the only. There are no words.
Right.
You're ahead of the language.
Exactly.
So, hey, when you're out there, you just kind of say, well, it's whoever I am. And you're just, you need to explain it. So I'm taking that to heart.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Kevin Kelly. His book is Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier. We'll talk more after a break. Both Whole Tech Nation programs and biotech-only interviews are available wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, technation.com and biotechnation.com. In the second half of our show, Dr. LeSean Acklog explains the simple diagnostic which can detect precancerous cells before they lead to esophageal cancer. And as with all cancer, early is definitely better. Stay with us. Thank you. You're listening to Tech Nation. I've been speaking with Wired Magazine's founding executive editor, Kevin Kelly, about excellent advice for living, wisdom I wish I'd known earlier. Now, you ended your last book, The Inevitables, and our interview was 7 years ago, if you can believe that. And you ended it with The Beginning, and it had the punchline, "The beginning is just beginning." Now, how do you frame, we touched on this a bit earlier, how do you frame what's happened in the last 7 years?
Oh my gosh, what's happened? Well, because we both live in Silicon Valley, we're very aware of that the sort of the elevated status of Silicon Valley has been lowered several notches because the inevitable problems that have arisen from the new technologies are very obvious to people. And for many, it's the first thing or the only thing they see about the kind of changes. So it's no longer the golden egg. It's much more the brass egg. I don't know what the analogy is. Some other metal, some other inferior metal. And so there is a sense in which people are now, when a new technology comes along, the initial reaction now is not wow, but what's wrong with it? There's something wrong with it. How is this going to bite me? How is this going to come back? What are we not seeing? How will this bite us? And that's the initial reaction. And that's a very different thing when I was growing up, when the technologies were seen as solutions to things. Now a new technology is immediately seen as a problem. And that's one of the shifts that we've seen, that bias. And so, when new things like the AI chats come out, there are people enthusiastic, but a lot of people are immediately looking for ways in which it's going to cause a problem, new problems. The other thing, of course, is it goes without saying, we've been on this long march toward AI that has recently accelerated, and there's been a big bang in that. And it reminds me of the very similar kind of energy there was at the beginning of the 90s. And my retelling of what that was about was we had the internet for years. It was very lonely because it was text only. You had to type, you had to do command line. It was hard to use. And then in 92 or 93, the graphical user interface was invented, which was the web. And then immediately everybody, I get it. I want it. I'm on. And within several years, transferred me from being ignored as a kind of a teenage boy thing to it's going to be mainstream with many doubters, but that was where it was obvious. And I think the same thing's happening now with AI, which has been around for years and years. The capabilities are not that much different, but now we have a conversational user interface and this big bang again, where there's this flood of people discovering and amazing new technologies. And every day there's something being released as we understand that there's this, not just a graphical user interface, but a conversational user interface, and not just speech like Siri or Alexa, but an actual conversation where you're probing and going back and forth. And we now have these universal personal interns at our disposal, and that's changing everything really, really fast. So that's been the main thing, is this conversational user interface applied to something that had been around for a while. And now we're going to apply it to everything that we make, is having, from cars to appliances, they'll be having conversations with these things.
Well, Kevin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. And, you're always welcome on Tech Nation.
Well, you're such an institution and a really positive force in the world, and of course in our neighborhood. And it's really a joy to always converse with you. Thank you for inviting me.
My guest today is Kevin Kelly. His book is Excellent Advice for Living, Wisdom I Wish I'd Known Earlier. It's published by Viking. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. From everyday people of average weight who don't smoke or drink, eat a healthy diet, and yet have suffered from heartburn, or its more technical name, GERD, to those of us with particular attributes, such as being male, or perhaps past the age of 40. Maybe you're a heavy smoker, or a heavy drinker. Perhaps you're obese, or at least overweight, or have worked in certain occupations which expose you to unhealthy substances, such as being a firefighter. The more boxes you check, the more likely you are to develop esophageal cancer. Normally only diagnosed in its very advanced state, Lucid Diagnostics has developed a 2-minute test which can detect these cancers when they are precancerous. Dr. LaShawn Aklog is Lucid's CEO. Dr. Aklog, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Maura. Thanks for having me.
You'd be hard-pressed to find an adult, especially as you get older, who has not had heartburn or GERD, or where someone close to them hasn't complained of heartburn or GERD. What is this, and how common is it?
You're absolutely right. It is extremely common. So we use the term heartburn. It's not a great term because it implies that it has something to do with your heart, and heartburn has nothing to do with your heart. It's a sensation after eating and in other situations where people just get this pain in the middle of their chest that is a result of a problem in the stomach and in the esophagus. The official medical term for it is has the initials GERD, G-E-R-D. And the fancy medical term is gastroesophageal reflux disease, but it's most commonly known as GERD. And it's extremely common. About 1 in 4 adults in America have what we call, what we would consider significant GERD, which is symptoms of at least once a week. And they take medications over the counter like Prilosec and Nexium to try to control those symptoms. And so it's a very, very common, a very big issue for many, many people.
Now, you're talking about stomach contents and stomach acid getting up above your stomach into your esophagus. Stomach acid has to do some damage to the esophagus, does it not?
So the acid in the stomach is meant to be there. It's meant to stay there in the stomach. It's not meant to go elsewhere. And it's in the stomach for obvious reasons, to help us digest our food and so forth. The esophagus is a food tube that drains into the esophagus, so it allows our food to enter the esophagus, but the acid is intended to stay within the stomach. So when the fluid in the stomach and acid and actually other things, bile and other things in the stomach, find their way into the lower esophagus, that's not a good thing. It's not supposed to, that fluid's not supposed to be there. The esophagus is not used to it, and it can cause havoc. It can cause symptoms of heartburn. But more concerning is it can cause changes in the cells in the lower part of the esophagus that can ultimately lead to precancerous conditions and to cancerous conditions. And so that's really where the damage can happen and what's the really serious consequences of GERD, which many people don't realize. Most people think heartburn, yeah, I take my Tums, I take my Maalox, or I take my Prilosec, and as long as my symptoms go away, I'm good to go. And that's not the case. It can actually lead to serious problems down the road.
You mentioned that a lot of people take antacids, and some of them actually rise to a prescription level. Won't that help you avoid this esophageal cancer?
No, this is the actual answer there. Surprisingly, no. So you're right. You know, we have pretty good medications right now to treat heartburn. I mentioned Nexium, Prilosec. These are a category of drugs called PPIs that can be available over the counter or by prescription. And they're very good at suppressing the acid and preventing the symptoms. And that's frankly one of the reasons why we treat GERD and heartburn as sort of just more of a nuisance than anything serious. That's the common feeling amongst patients and their doctors. But that's just not true, that when you treat the symptoms, you're just masking it. the process of the cells of the lower esophagus being exposed to the stomach contents and undergoing these changes into precancer continues unrelented. And it's actually, it can be sort of dangerous because people feel a sense of
they have it under control.
Yeah. It's really masking an underlying process that could actually progress to more serious conditions.
So for some of these people, it will lead to esophageal cancer. How common is that? And who is at risk?
So that's true. So you can develop, people with heartburn and with reflux can develop a precancerous condition, and a subset of those patients can, it can evolve to a late precancer and then ultimately to full-blown esophageal cancer. Esophageal cancer, the diagnosis of esophageal cancer is made about 20,000 Americans a year. By the time we're done with this conversation, about a dozen Americans will get that diagnosis. And the tragedy is that in nearly all those cases, it's a near death sentence. About 80% of people who are diagnosed with cancer will be dead in 5 years. So it's one of our worst, most lethal cancers out there. It's up there with pancreatic cancer and liver cancer as kind of the big three most deadly cancers. About 16,000 people will die every year. And look, all deaths are tragic, all cancer deaths are tragic, but those 16,000 are particularly tragic because we know the evolution, we know where it came from, we know how to identify it early, and we know how to prevent it, and we're just not doing so.
Let me just stay with this for a while. Is there a profile of people who tend to develop into esophageal cancer?
Yeah. So it's the best place to start is who's at risk for having the precancer, because once you have the precancer, then you have a very, very high possibility through your lifetime of it evolving into later stage precancers, into cancer itself. So there are very well established, we know who's at risk for that. Anybody who has GERD or chronic heartburn, that's a major risk factor. And then a few other demographic characteristics, such as people over 50, white race, men, smokers, obese people, and those who have a family history. So that's GERD plus six other risk factors. And anyone who has three of those six risk factors has about a 10% chance of having the precancerous condition. That needs to be identified, as well, I think we'll talk about in a second, because we don't want to wait until the cancer develops.
Now, let me ask you this. We're not going to be talking about a cancer test. We're going to be going after the precancerous. And today there is no precancerous test. Is that right?
There's no test that's easy to perform that's widely utilized. You can do endoscopies, where you take a camera and you go to the endoscopy center, and two people take the day off of work, and you're under anesthesia, and they put this big tube in your esophagus and your stomach, and sure, you can pick it up that way. And actually, that test is recommended, but almost nobody gets it. Only about 1 in 20 of the tens of millions of people who are recommended for testing, who should be getting tested, ever get that. So you're right. There has not been a simple, straightforward test that could be utilized on a widespread basis to identify those patients who have this precancerous condition that can be addressed to prevent the progression to cancer.
Now, you're talking about, you know, the search for precancerous cells, and women hear this a lot. They get a pap test and they say, well, we're looking for precancerous, and it sounds very vague. I mean, you're like, okay, go look. We're not really sure what it means. What does it mean, this precancerous, and how specific is it?
Yeah. So that's a great analogy. That what we're talking about in the esophagus is very similar to what we talk about with pap testing. And so precancerous changes are abnormalities to otherwise previously normal cells that can be detected in a variety of ways that indicate that a process has begun that can head towards later stages and then ultimately to cancer. And so what's exciting in the esophageal space, we've had pap testing for decades now, and it's had a big impact on saving lives and preventing deaths from cervical cancer. We now have the same opportunity in esophageal cancer, where technology that was funded by the National Cancer Institute out of Case Western Reserve University and other academic medical centers have been developed that allows us to identify 21 sites on two very specific genes where these early abnormalities can occur to the DNA at those 21 sites and can indicate at the very earliest stage that that process has begun and can progress to later stages.
Lucid Diagnostics has not just created a test for identifying these cells, they've also created a way to collect those cells. Tell us about that, how you go and collect these esophageal cells.
Yeah, it's great. They really go hand in hand. I mean, the science behind these 21 sites on two genes is absolutely remarkable. It's cutting edge. The way we can identify that is amazing in the laboratory. But in order to do that molecular work, you have to get the cells where the abnormality is. And as you said, the abnormalities that are occurring here are subtle, and they occur at the very end of the esophagus, just before the stomach. So that's a good ways down. It's a couple of feet from your mouth to that point. And so how do you collect cells like that without having to undergo this invasive procedure? And so what was developed by the same brilliant scientists was not just the molecular test, but a way to collect those cells in a very simple way that can be done in an office setting. So how is it done? The tool is quite simple. There's a capsule that's about the size of a vitamin pill. It's attached to a silicone catheter, which is basically like a little piece of spaghetti, a thin piece of maybe angel hair spaghetti. And on the end of the capsule, there's a balloon that can be inflated or deflated. And so what the patient does is the patient swallows that capsule. It's tethered still to the little piece of spaghetti. And that capsule works its way down into the stomach. And the person who's administering the test will inflate the balloon and pull back just at where the stomach meets the esophagus. And so remarkably, without any cameras or any other sort of fancy technology, just with a fairly simple device, we know where the balloon is because it's right at that juncture between the stomach and the esophagus. And then it just gently swabs or collects the cells just like you would in any other kind of swab test. It picks up those cells. And then with the balloon deflated, those cells get pulled into the capsule and it gets removed. Pulled right out of your mouth. And the whole thing takes a couple of minutes. No anesthesia. And no other intervention can be done in a doctor's office. And again, what's remarkable at that from a physician's point of view is like, wow, we can actually collect cells exactly where the problem is in a very targeted way without exposing the sample to other cells anywhere else in the body and be able to send those cells off to a fancy laboratory that can do this fancy molecular genetic testing.
And no other appointments in another building. Just sit over here.
Nope.
Sit where you
exactly.
are. We got you.
No IVs, no nothing.
Now, the whole idea that I am swallowing this thing, and even though there's this, it seems like, oh, it's small. It's like angel hair. It's following it down. I'm like, how do I get it down? I keep thinking I'm going to gag on this. Have you done this?
I've done it myself. It's sort of a requirement that everybody in the company does. We had a board meeting this week, and we forced a couple of the board members to have the test done. And our team is incredibly well-trained on how to do this. And people do sort of look at something as like, I don't know, can I swallow that? And will that go down? And 99% of the time, it works just fine. There's a few people here and there who have trouble swallowing pills, who have a hard time getting it down, but that's like 1 in 100. And just with the proper training and with the proper coaching, it's over in the blink of an eye. And it's actually quite comfortable and really not an issue at all. And we've done that, you know, tens of thousands of times.
And so many people, you know, they think about, okay, how can I get this down? And once you get it sort of just swallowed, your body kind of takes it the rest of the way, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just like swallowing a pill, right? If you're swallowing a vitamin pill, once it's, you only have to swallow until it's past the back of your throat. And that's what your esophagus does. Your esophagus contracts and relaxes and basically can move food and pills, and in this case, our capsule, into the stomach, just like it would a pill or a food.
And then somebody pulls it out. How tough is that?
Piece of cake. Yeah, it happens quickly and you hardly notice. Honestly, just in all seriousness, the part that people concern themselves more is with the swallowing part. Once you've swallowed it, the rest of the procedure is really quite straightforward and very comfortable.
But I like this. After the test, they give you a piece of cake. I think that would be that's a good marketing yeah. plan. But we won't talk about that.
We won't talk about that. But you know what? What the patients appreciate is they know what the alternative. And we actually track this data, like patient satisfaction. It's very important that we know that we get feedback from patients, and what they appreciate is the opportunity to get an answer as to whether they're at risk for developing this horrible cancer, and that that answer can be obtained with such a simple cell collection procedure that can be done in an office setting. So we have a lot of gratitude, particularly those in whom we find an abnormality where they didn't suspect it.
Do we have procedures to treat it at the precancerous stage?
Yeah. So yes, exactly. So the reason why early detection, whether it's what we're doing, which is pre-cancer detection, or early detection of cancers like breast and colon and stage one, the only reason that's useful is if you can do something about it after you've picked it up early. So that's a necessary part of having a successful early detection program. It's not only that you have to be able to detect the problem, but you have to be able to do something about it that alters the course for that particular patient. So, and that's why those other early detection programs have been wildly successful at decreasing deaths. Deaths from breast cancer, deaths from colon cancer, deaths from cervical cancer are all substantially lower, 50% or more lower, because of early detection programs. So for this to be a successful early detection program, it has to leverage the fact that once we identify the precancer condition, then those patients who have a positive result will get an endoscopy. And that endoscopy will determine where along the spectrum are they. Are they at the earliest stages of precancer? Or perhaps were we fortunate to pick up a late precancer before it developed into cancer? And then the appropriate management follows. So if somebody's in a very early stage precancer, that just requires surveillance. So you come in, just like people get a colonoscopy on a regular basis. You would come in typically every 3 years and get another endoscopy to determine whether to catch it, to see if it progresses from one to the other. If at the beginning or through later surveillance, you detect that it's progressed to the later stage cancer, but still before cancer, then you have the opportunity and the need to intervene. And the intervention there is what's called an ablation procedure, where you can go in with in a very minimally invasive way. You can eliminate those abnormal precancerous cells and reliably prevent them from progressing to cancer and actually prevent the cancer. So exactly right. That's the whole point of picking these things up early, is so you can monitor and treat them to prevent them from developing into cancer.
So it's not unlike the colonoscopy saying, well, we found this, we found that, we took this out, we took these polyp out, we did this, and we're going to watch you, and we're going to keep coming back with this to make sure.
Yes.
That it doesn't develop.
Yes, and if you find an abnormality, you remove it. Very similar, the similar prospect. So that's how you prevent it from developing into cancer. And that's what's great here, is that it's actually well established on how you do that. We just haven't been finding those patients. So it goes back to what I said at the beginning, Mara, which is that every esophageal cancer death is particularly tragic because we know what to do. We know if we find the precancer early, we know how to prevent the cancer. And so nobody should be dying of esophageal cancer, because we know who should be tested, and we know if we test them, we can pick up these early conditions and monitor and intervene in a way to prevent them from developing cancer.
Now, I want to mention this. We talked about the Pap test, and I noticed that the vice chair of your board and the strategic advisor is Stan Lapidus. And it was Stan Lapidus that developed both the modern Pap test that we all use now and Cologuard, which we're all aware of. He's an engineer.
That's right. So you're right. We're very fortunate to have Stan Lapidus as our vice chairman and a close advisor to me and to the company. And Stan is a legend in this space, and he's had such an incredible impact first with cervical cancer. He invented the ThinPrep device, which is the way the modern Pap test is done. As you said, he's an engineer. The original prototypes of that are actually on display at the Smithsonian Institute. And it's been estimated that about 1 billion women have undergone Pap testing using his technologies, and that has led to the saving millions of lives. What an impact for an individual. And he's done the same thing. He was the co-founder and co-inventor of the Cologuard stool DNA test. And this is the third cancer that he's working on with us, because he understands the value of early detection and cancer prevention, and believes our technology has the opportunity to do the same thing for esophageal cancer that the ThinPrep and Cologuard have done for cervical and colon cancer, respectively.
And one last thing I wanted to note is that we talked about who in the general population was susceptible, more susceptible, that profile. But there's another group of people who are especially susceptible, and that's firefighters.
That's correct. So, you know, firefighters, they're our heroes, right? They go in and literally walk into burning buildings to save us and others. And in the process of doing that, they're exposed to a variety of toxic substances. Firefighters have an overall elevated risk of cancer. A large percentage of firefighters die of cancer. And if you list all the cancers that have that they have a particularly increased risk of, esophageal cancer is the second most, the second greatest, about 60 to 70% increased chance of developing esophageal cancer compared to average, the average population. So we've embraced that. And we've, you know, there's a lot of attention within the firefighter community at cancer prevention. There are a lot of programs, and we've embraced that. And we've engaged now in dozens of firefighters across the country where we have health fair events, where we come on site and identify those who are at risk, and we test them. We do the cell collection and test them for esophageal precancer, and we found dozens of cases of that, and we're helping to have that kind of impact. And it's particularly gratifying in that population because of the heroic work that they do.
Now, if you are a fire department somewhere in the country, can you partake in that program?
Absolutely. Yeah, we love hearing from fire departments. And as I said, most have an interest in cancer prevention. And we've been able to work closely with the fire departments and the chiefs that are focused on this to bring programs on site, sometimes with the active, but often even with the retired firefighters from that department, so we can test everybody who has potential risk. So, yeah, that's a partnership that we've been expanding across the country, and we would look forward to hearing from any departments that would like to participate in that.
Well, Dr. Aklog, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you come back and see us again.
This has been great. Thank you, Maria. I really appreciate it.
Dr. LaShawn Aklog is the CEO of Lucid Diagnostics. More information is available on the web at luciddx.com. That's luciddx.com. For Technation, I'm Moira Gunn.
TechNation and its regular segment BioTechNation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. TechNation and BioTechNation are productions of TechNation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.